This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And this week, even though it seems a little early, seems a little quick, I didn't really take into account how long it's been since our last Jason special.
No, I was ready for it.
He was ready. He did. Sometimes the only thing that determines whether or not we have a Jason special is when Jason comes to me and is like, hey, I know what I want to talk about. Sometimes that's every month. Sometimes that's every 3 months, and that's okay. It's whatever makes him happy. But I, as host of this program, am going to hesitantly hand over the reins.
How many times have I done this?
I think this is this 10?
I have no idea, but it hasn't been destructive.
This might be it. Let me see. Details. Jason special 10.
Dang.
Rocky.
Wow. I don't know. There's not 10 Rocky movies, but
yeah,
if there were,
Rocky!
It'd probably be as bad as this will be.
All right. That's fair. So I am going to relinquish my power. I do still have the computer here in front of me.
He can just
stop this at any time.
If I say anything that seems too rational, that's it. Cut off.
We go. I'm physically he's transferring an invisible ball of presenter energy over to Jason, and now I wither and die.
And this episode will now be in memorandum with Samuel Fredrickson.
All right.
Okay.
Good.
So, anyway, guys, hello and welcome to another one of me. I'm sorry.
Another one of me?
Yeah, me time. It's never mind. This is all awful.
I thought you were
instantaneously upset with myself.
I thought you were going to say another one of my specials, and then you said me, and so then my brain was like, another one of me specials.
Me specials.
Like a pirate, which is actually...
Which is accurate, and also a spoiler. So in case any of you guys were assuming, based off of my last Jason special, that I was going to be talking about the Legend of King Arthur, well, you assumed wrong, and I am constantly coming up with different ideas.
Did you mention
recently
that in your last special? Oh.
Yeah, you're like, what are you going to cover next? I don't know. Maybe King Arthur himself. He's got a lot of crazy stories out there.
Yeah, he does.
He's still doing a lot of stuff, even though he's been dead for theoretically like 1,200 years.
If he ever lived at all.
Exactly.
Ooh.
Poof.
There we go. All right.
Expect bad stage magic on that. Anyway, recently I've been brought to the attention of maps from long ago that depict things that should not be there. What I mean by that is I mean the Perry Reese map, which is a map that was, written in 1513, but rediscovered recently in 1929. Now, the importance of this map comes to a certain, well, several different degrees. One of the big things that was recently grasped on by theorists is that the map itself depicts the upper region of Antarctica, which...
Now, how, for our listeners who might want to look at this map as you're talking about it...
Yeah. How is that spelled?
How do you spell this?
So
I'm asking just for the listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Obviously not myself.
Perry is P-I-R-I.
Okay.
Space. Reese is R-E-I-S. Map. And that's it. It's known by the author of the map.
Perfect. Perfect.
And we'll be getting into him as well. Of course. What do you think of it, Sam? Today you are a listener.
I'm loving it.
Yeah, I think it's really cool.
It's bizarre, and I don't understand what's going on here. I'm going to look for a better picture.
I'm going to be talking quite heavily about what's going on there.
Okay.
But first, before we actually dive into the map itself and its what it contains, we need to talk a little bit more about Perry Reese. Now, Perry Reese literally just translates to Admiral Perry. Reese is just a title.
Oh.
Perry Reese was an admiral of the Ottoman fleet in the mid-16th century. He actually has a really important career, but weirdly enough, even though the map itself does depict a lot of the New World, Perry actually never made it outside of the Mediterranean Sea. or even, well, west of Spain himself. Instead, he actually commanded the fleet primarily in the Mediterranean and also the Persian Gulf. He eventually got beheaded in 1553 at the age of 90.
Wow.
He was still admiral at that point in time. He was actually beheaded because he refused to support the Ottoman governor of, here we go, Basra. We're nice. Good. Killing which it. Is which Killing is a port it. City in modern day Iraq.
Wow. They beheaded a 90-year-old.
They beheaded a 90-year-old admiral with almost a perfect record.
Huh.
In fact, the reason why I assume he refused is because the only time he really met failure throughout his military career was attempts to acquire strategic islands in the Gulf of the Persia Gulf against the Portuguese, which is not particularly notable. It's at this point in time, we're talking about colonialism and essentially just grabbing as many,
just snatch it.
Yeah, as many locations as possible for ensuring trade routes and things like that and getting that upper hand. Early in his career, though, is the fun part because when he was younger, he actually served underneath another admiral, which just happened to be his uncle at the time. And they were, well, state-given pirates. They were privateers.
Oh, yes.
Which is awesome. In again, wonderful. The Mediterranean Sea. And that lasted up until about 1510 with the death of his uncle.
Okay, okay.
In a short period of time, basically from 1510 to 1516, he actually just kind of did his own thing for a bit, studied more about cartography and geography, and that's actually where the map that we're going to be talking about later comes from. Once 1516 ran around, he actually became a sea captain again and then started just winning battles across the Mediterranean, eventually becoming admiral and finding a lot of success until his death.
All right. All right. Sounds like a pretty normal life.
I mean, I get what?
Well,
it sounds incredibly cool.
Well, okay.
First off, he was a pirate.
This is what I'm not saying, or this is what I'm saying, is it doesn't sound like he went down to Antarctica or discovered any new continents. And it doesn't sound like he was given special knowledge by the ancient aliens.
Right. Not yet.
So my bad.
I have 6 years to discuss here, Sam.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I'll just settle in.
Okay. So he actually created two different works. One was actually published in 1521. He later revised it just a few years later, but it's basically translates to the Book of the Sea, which is actually extremely cool. He charted a lot of the area that he was actually in and being an admiral of, so mostly the Mediterranean and the Persian Gulf, but also created a vast map of the seven seas, as was known at the time, and also describes things like ports, weather conditions, for example, like swells in the ocean and just travel, just flow of water as well, which is pretty important if you're going to be a sea captain. Mm. So he created a pretty big book and map of that. But what we are going to be focusing on today is actually an earlier work of his in 1513. He published the Peri Reis map. It was actually completed in 1517, and he gave it to the Ottoman Sultan of the time, which was Selim the First.
Nice, killing it.
That's what I'm going to go with.
Solid.
And the map itself was actually kind of a culmination of 20 other different charts and maps that predated it.
Oh, really?
It's really interesting to say because these maps and charts include source reference material such as 8 Ptolemaic maps, which is an early Hellenistic map dating back to about 200 AD. He has an Arabic map of India as reference as well, 4 recently drawn Portuguese maps from southern Pakistan, and a map of the New World drawn by Columbus himself. Now that's important because the maps that charted the West Indies was lost to time, supposedly. But theoretically, it's not too hard to say that maybe that was one of the maps he stole as a pirate. How cool would that
Whoa.
Be? We can't say for sure.
So he's stealing things and using them.
That is what privateering is.
Yes. Wow.
For the gain of the Ottoman Empire.
A criminal.
For the gain of the Ottoman Empire.
All right.
Legal criminal.
Just like Sir Francis Drake.
But that is important, because up until that time and ever since, archaeologists and historians have not found any charts that Christopher Columbus supposedly wrote or illustrated of the Indies. So that is a pretty important point. Otherwise, we also have a little bit of scrutiny and, well, debate, a part of some of those, God, what's the name again?
Ptolemaic.
Ptolemaic, thank you. The Ptolemaic maps, because there are two Ptolemies that we should be talking about. And that's where it gets confusing.
Okay.
The two that we're actually speaking of is Ptolemy the First, who is a general that was under Alexander the Great in about 332 BCE, which is sweet. But he was mostly a geographer, didn't do too much for cartography. And if we remember correctly, Alexander the Great's conquest was by land, not by sea.
Hmm.
So he wasn't really doing much naval warfare at that time. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that anything written by this man would be focused around the sea itself, but more geographical in that nature.
Okay. I can follow that train of reasoning.
And the other is Claudius Ptolemy, who lived in the 2nd century AD.
Mm.
Now, this is important because Claudius Ptolemy did actually make maps. He was a cartographer and geographer at that time. Now, what gets kind of fuzzy is the fact that a lot of Arabic writers did get the two mixed up throughout time. So Perry Reese believes that the maps and charts that he had were from the original Ptolemy, the first, during Alexander's age. So there's speculation that those charts could have come from the Library of Alexandria before it burnt down, potentially. We're going to dive in a little bit later about how I think it's mostly just a mistaken identity crisis going on, and not necessarily these long-lost maps that some people are kind of leaping into believing.
All right, all right.
Now, for the map itself, again, it was lost to time until about 1929. And the only thing that we have remaining is actually about a third of it, which is horrible. It's a shortfall.
It doesn't seem like I'm seeing the whole world here.
You have about a third of it. It was originally written on a gazelle hide, which is also incredibly cool. But it was rediscovered at a library in Istanbul by a German who is a person that categorizes stuff? Anyway, this guy in an Istanbul library was going through a lot of old stuff.
Okay.
And putting it in the
an
correct
archivist?
Spot. There we go. Maybe? That'll work. Yeah. Okay. An archivist. That's correct terminology enough.
Sure.
An archivist is kind of just fell over it and rediscovered it. Now, when you're looking at the map, again, it only shows about one third of the actual world. And it was, to Perry Reese's time, as accurate as a map could get. Now, comparing that to what we have today, if you do look up a photo of it, it's pretty tough to say it's accurate.
I don't even know what I'm looking at here.
Well, I'll tell you. The map itself, the remaining that we have, does illustrate essentially the west coast of Africa, and then the east coast of both North and South America, and also the West Indies. Now, this is why it's important, because if Perry Reese is correct on these charts that was written originally by Columbus himself, that's actually pretty significant for our history. If it is his exact representation, then, well, we've kind of rediscovered those maps and those charts within this one, which is really cool. Now, there's a few other things that, if you look at it closely enough, some stuff is a little bit off. For example, for me, it feels like a lot of the left-hand side of the map, where we do have the east coast of South America, and then we do have a little bit of Central America, it seems like he ran out of space.
It does. It kind of curves drastically.
It curves physically with the edge of the map.
Yeah.
Now, some people, because the lower left-hand corner is kind of missing altogether, where that should be the lower half of South America, it curves inward.
Okay.
Some people believe that the lower left-hand corner of the map was just destroyed by time, and that the coastline depicts the northern end of Antarctica. That has a couple different issues. One, South America is actually in the correct longitude line that it should be in relation to West Africa, which is great. So they are in the correct spots. Now, from there, Antarctica would not be halfway up the map. From there, it looks like Antarctica, the top of it, is basically right below Brazil, if you draw right across.
So this
which that doesn't make too much sense.
So the idea for anyone looking at the map, and it goes up and down, it's more of like a portrait orientation rather than a landscape, so make sure we're looking at it in the right orientation. So I definitely see what's probably South America, right? And it's
yeah, the,
jutting
like I said,
out.
Like the coast of Brazil uh-huh. is obvious.
And then people are thinking that right underneath where it curves, that curve is Antarctica. Is that the idea?
Correct. I know.
I don't really like that. That doesn't sound legit to me.
And see, that's why if we just talked about the map, we'd basically be done
okay.
already.
All right.
And that's not quite so much
no.
fun. So, and there's a couple other scrutinies that I have, obviously, for it as well. For example, we absolutely know that there's a lot more curvature when it comes to Central America. It doesn't go pretty much vertical as far as the coastline goes. And then, to be completely honest with you, Cape Horn, which is the very tip bottom of South America, wasn't even discovered yet at that time either.
Oh, interesting.
And neither was Antarctica. Most of Antarctica wasn't even charted until 1891 with a Norwegian expedition to actually see it and do that great research and stuff like that. But that's the scrutiny, really.
Now,
yeah,
as I'm looking at this,
yes.
do you have it up in front of you?
No, but I've memorized it.
Okay. I believe you.
I've stared at it a long time.
Okay, so we're looking. We've got Brazil.
Yes.
Pretty sure that's Brazil.
And then pretty much directly below Brazil, it starts to essentially kind of scorpion tail inward.
Yep. Now, as it scorpion tails inward, we follow the coastline, and then near the very bottom of the map, there is a significant indentation in the landmass with a group of, it looks to be about 8 islands right there. Those islands, do they correspond? Are there islands near or on the Antarctic or South American coast that would correspond to that place?
They are.
Which one? South America?
That would be the Canary Islands, and that they're off of South America.
They're off of South America. Okay.
What's also great about this map, it does also show other Atlantic islands as well, including the Azores, but also fictional islands as well.
Hmm.
So at that point in time, just like we've talked about before with hidden islands or just mystical lands in general, this map also shows that too. So it does bring in a lot of what we've already talked about in the past with previous maps and exploration into it, which is really, really cool. Now, some people do believe that this is the northern point of Antarctica.
Okay.
Which
Why?
That gets credence.
Okay.
Because of a man named Arlington H. Mallory, who was a civil engineer and also an amateur archaeologist as well. Now, he basically took a picture of Antarctica without ice on it. And after looking at the picture of Antarctica and looking at the map itself, he was dead set sure that would be the shoreline of the Queen Maud Land coastline in Antarctica, which is essentially the pointy bit of Antarctica.
Okay.
When you're looking, which is right next to South America.
Okay.
So if you look at a world map of Antarctica, that essentially, you have the Antarctic Peninsula, and it's basically that same region.
Okay, I see it.
Okay. Now, with that, it's also to note that he's a part of the U.S. military at this point in time, and this was in, 1949, I believe. He did report it to his supervisors from there, and his supervisor from the tail confirms and also believes that. Now, for anyone that has access to the internet, we also have photos of Antarctica and the Antarctic coast without the ice on it, because we can do that with lasers. We can cut through the ice and we can see exactly what the geography looks like. And if we look at it today, well, you could actually just cut it out and try to spin around what Antarctica should be, and it doesn't fit that coastline whatsoever that's depicted for the bottom of the map. So I don't really see how it's possibly there.
Okay.
Which is unfortunate. Another reason why it's unfortunate is that Antarctica hasn't been free of ice in 34 million years. So it's really suspicious to say that anyone should know what it looks like underneath Antarctica, because there is 1.6 kilometers of ice on top of Antarctica in any one given area. And that ice sheet would be enough that if it melted, would raise our sea levels by 60 meters.
Oh no, God. No.
That is the future we have to live
with.
Which is great. Also, there's some ideas that there could potentially be a lost civilization underneath it. To that, I say, well, it's been frozen for so long, I don't really think that's the case. And also, if the ice did melt, guess what? It's basically just going to be gravel and bedrock, because all the actual clay, sand, dirt, everything else has been essentially eroded to time from the melting of ice that's actually on the cap itself. So it's going to be incredibly difficult to grow anything on it. In fact, if it did ever melt, it would probably be major, just basically another land grab. So colonization 2.0, except without colonies, it's basically just going to be for resources.
Yeah.
That's the big thing. Oil is probably the big one. Oil, coal, and potentially precious metals and elements. So That'd be like the biggest thing, biggest benefit of Antarctica not being covered in ice. Although Antarctica is super cool looking, I think the landmass itself is actually the fifth largest continent on the world, which has never been inhabited, which is incredibly interesting. Also, what's really cool is that once the ice does melt off of it, it will slowly rise back up. The pressure and weight of all the ice on it has actually pushed it into the crust of the Earth.
And then what happens?
And then it actually becomes one solid landmass. Because as of right now, if the ice did melt away from it, it would basically be one medium-sized landmass, not anything to really write home about, and then a bunch of islands. Once it rises back up from the crust itself, it would actually become pretty much a solid landmass and two large islands.
Would that affect our lives in some way?
Remember that 60 meters of water I was talking about?
Well, yes, that obviously is not
good.
I
hope you don't want to move to Florida.
I don't. Florida, goodbye.
Basically,
submerge.
You could say goodbye to most of the southeast of America.
Wow. But what about the actual lifting up
that
of
won't
the
actually,
continent?
That actually won't do too much for us, because that'll actually take thousands of years. Because
it's...
It'd be a very gradual depressurization.
All right.
Which is a good thing. Because
to me, it seems like that should make the world split in half like an egg. So
No. It's pretty cool, but not necessarily anything that we have to really shake home or worry about.
Now, as I'm looking at a modern-day map...
Yeah.
An undistorted, because of course...
So yeah, there's the thing, too, is that looking at maps is confusing.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of different ways that people have attempted to take a three-dimensional object and put it onto a two-dimensional plane. None of them keep the truth to it. Yeah.
But
the map that we use today essentially stretches the top and the bottom of the world to make it fit into, well, the rectangle that we have it. So anything that is close to the poles is actually stretched vertically quite a bit and makes it look a lot larger than it actually is.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind.
And they also make Europe look like it's some big thing and Africa look quite not as large. Did you ever watch The West Wing?
No.
Oh, my God.
That was the 90s with, it was Michael Sheen?
Martin Sheen. So in this, they have this thing where every so often they just let members of the public come to the White House and talk to members of the cabinet in order to like get their ideas across and stuff like that. And one of them is this organization, and it has Nick Offerman in it from before he was famous. Yeah.
Okay.
And they're there to campaign about maps. And like, they talk about how the map that is shown in school, like in
is incorrect.
It's completely incorrect. Like, it makes Europe look huge. It makes the North America look huge, and it makes Africa look like it's smaller than North America, when in reality, Africa is much larger than both North America and Europe combined. And it's just distorted in this way. And so then they show CJ is her name. They show her the actual map of how it would look undistorted, and it like freaks her out. And then they were like, and if we wanted to, we could even take this map, and then they turn it upside down and display it this way. And she's like, no, you can't. That freaks me out. And it's like, but it's true.
Yeah.
because of how everything works, like, there is no up, there is no down. Like, yes, there's north, south, east, west, but why does north have to be pointing up? It's all influenced through colonialism and through the propagation of the Eurocentric model of reality.
Right. Yeah, it absolutely is.
However, looking at this undistorted map, or as close as we can get to undistorted map, that tip, you said it was the Queen Maud land?
Yeah.
That tip is suspiciously close to the bottom of South America.
It is. Yeah, it's actually incredibly close to South America. You would be able to take a boat to it easily. Wow. Probably within, I mean, even at that point in time, probably within a week. It's not that
saying,
far of a sail.
You're saying that when Piri Reis made his map, they hadn't reached the bottom tip of South America to begin with.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Now, a couple other things that we want to talk about. First, and I will dive into the idea that potentially different civilization did chart the full world at some point in time. Okay. And then this map was influenced by that finding.
Cool.
So we're going to talk about a little bit more of the history of seafaring and wayfinding and all together. But something else that I should probably bring up before we dive too much into that is one other teeny tiny little issue about map making, and that's called the Terra Australis Incognita, which is a fancy way.
Hidden Australian land?
Kind of. It's really the idea that some sort of landmass has to exist at the bottom of the world to counterbalance all the landmass in the Northern Hemisphere. It was actually proposed by Claudius Ptolemy. Thank God. Why can't the P throws me off every time.
Just ignore
Claudius
it.
Claudius Ptolemy.
Okay.
And all of his maps showed some sort of landmass. And so it was essentially culturally appropriate in a lot of ways, and tradition in a lot of ways, to have some sort of bottom, various-shaped landmass that we don't know of.
Okay.
As a way to kind of cap the world,
so
to speak.
Was he the first person to propose this, as far as we know? In 200 AD? Or in the second century?
Yeah.
Was it the 200s or the second century?
200.
Okay. Interesting. Does that make sense? Do planets work that way?
No, they don't.
Okay.
And we know that now. But I mean, that makes a lot of sense when you think about balance, spin, that kind of thing.
Sure,
it would make sense for there to be an equilibrium somewhere.
But what about all the water? The water is heavy.
Is it as heavy as landmass?
I don't know.
Probably not. I don't actually know either.
I think a bucket of dirt and a bucket of water weigh probably about the same.
Well, 1 gallon of water, fresh water, weighs roughly around 8 to 10 pounds, depending on your altitude. From there, salt water is heavier because, well, it's salinity in it.
Yeah.
And so thus it's more dense. So I'd expect it to probably be about maybe 10 to 12 pounds potentially per gallon.
Okay.
That seems about
what a bucket of dirt would weigh. Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
It doesn't particularly matter because we know about plate tectonics. We know about.
Yeah. And then there's land underneath the water too. Did they know that?
Did they know there is a bottom? I assume that they would think so, because there's bottoms to lakes, you know?
I guess that's fair. Okay.
It's weird because, you know, for a long time, people thought the Earth was flat, but in reality, others had already known that it was round.
We already knew that it was round for a very long time.
The Egyptians figured it out,
yeah.
Which is incredibly cool, and they figured out early into their dynasties.
Yeah.
Just by basic mathematics.
Yeah.
So the idea, it's just the distortion of our history and how we view the world is weird, man.
Yeah.
It is all over the place.
Because it took the Europeans longer than the Egyptians to figure it out.
Well, so here's the thing about that. The Fertile Crescent, including Egypt.
Let's call it what it is, Mesopotamia. I just love that word. Go ahead.
Well, Mesopotamia is more... Okay, anyway, so the Fertile Crescent, basically the birthplace of civilization, culture, trade, and also seafaring in the Western world. That's where it all started anyway. I mean, because from there...
they built ziggurats.
Things like written language traveled from Egypt and Mesopotamia to Greece as well after that. So the thought exercise of how the Earth is shaped... That started long ago, before Christianity was close to being a thing. And then I just don't know where that cutoff between the Earth is round to the Earth is flat, clearly. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. I guess it's more of the Earth-centric idea. But anyway, back to topic here. We will be talking a little bit more about Greek culture and also just Mediterranean trades in just a second.
All right, man. I just wanted to rant.
Because we're gonna talk about what it takes to be really seafaring. And now,
a boat.
Well, yes, but a boat that can be seaworthy is important.
All right.
You probably shouldn't be going out in like a little lifeboat. That's probably a bad idea. Or a little fishing boat that you just take on the lake. Probably not good. No rowboats, Sam. I'm sorry.
Dang.
Now, as far as how humans conquered the globe, well, it took a long time, to say the least. Anatomically correct humans have been around for about 200,000 years. To give you a rough estimate. Otherwise, as far as a human that, say, theoretically, if we went back in time and grabbed a person, how far back could we go to grab a person that wouldn't be completely disassociated with our society now? Essentially, how long ago do we have to go back to where we find a human that will be able to comprehend advanced language that we have and be able to comprehend and actually function well in the world that we have today?
Well, function well is one thing, but I think to understand society and understand like settled civilization and the stability that that brings to our reality that allows us to create art and science and
technology. Say we steal a baby.
Okay.
Well, that's what I'm theoretically getting
at. If that was the case, if we stole a baby, we could go back much further.
How far do you think we'd go?
Well, I was going to say, if we're stealing like a full-grown man, we could probably go back.
Oh, no, that'd be rough. No, no, no.
We'd probably go back to like 9,000 BC, I think. 9,000, 10,000 is when we'd really be able to understand like settlements and science. It would take a very long time for this man to understand, but he could do it. If we're stealing a baby, we could go back like 150,000 years or something, man.
About half that.
Okay, 75,000 years, man. We could take this baby.
The farthest we could probably go back is about 70,000 years.
Okay.
The major reason is that, yes, anatomically correct humans have been around much longer than that, but we
brains.
It is.
Okay.
It took a long time to evolve into what we are now, to where we can actually have a real conversation. We have advanced cognitive skills that no other animal on Earth has. So we can't go that far back in time. So let's take our frame of reference to 70,000 years ago.
Okay.
Well, 70,000 years ago, we were still, for the most part, trying to conquer the world. We haven't even left Africa, for the most part. It took until about 16,000 years ago before we even got to North America and then South America and also moved down to Australia as well.
Okay.
So at this point in time, 16,000 years ago, mankind had pretty much made it to the reaches of the world. We have made it out of Africa and populated most areas.
Okay.
Most. There's a few very, very distant lands that we haven't quite gotten to. The very, very bottom of South America, not quite. But that is generally where we're at now. From there, we have been stuck in pretty much an ice age for a very long time.
Yeah.
Also, though, to keep in reference, we have already domesticated, at this point, dogs.
Wow.
Dogs were domesticated about 33,000 years ago.
Wow.
So we have doggos. Thank goodness. And then about...
That'll make everything easier.
20,000 years ago, we have ovens, we have signs of clothing, baskets, things like that. And about this time as well, we have the first signs of man waging war against himself. So at this point in time, we have things conquest, we have better food preparation. We are ready for our exploratory and expansion into the entire world. And that's where we see a lot of our expansion is in this time point. Now, the thing to it is that this is also the time where we're still definitely locked in the Stone Age. We haven't found anything implying that we are out of the Stone Age whatsoever. And then we are still also in an Ice Age. About 13,000 years ago, though, we started releasing from the Ice Age. The ice started receding back to the poles, and things were starting to look a lot better for us. Until a massive lake hidden underneath the North American ice sheet, which would have rivaled the size of the Black Sea, to put it in relation for y'all. essentially got released into the Atlantic Ocean from these ice dams that gave way. Now, what that actually happened, and what that did is create an influx of cold, fresh water into the Atlantic Ocean. Why is that an issue? Well, it's because as water travels north, it becomes denser and colder. Its salinity increases, which causes the water, the really, really cold Atlantic water, to essentially drop to the seafloor to eventually slowly come back down to the equator, get warmed up again, rise to the surface, and then push back. Exactly. But this is one of the main reasons why the Earth was getting warmer, and that's why the Earth stayed warmer. But with all this influx of brand new fresh water hitting the ocean, it put that on ice. Literally, it just pretty much shut down that system of warm climate movement. And then put us back into an ice age known as the Younger Dryas for about 2,000 years before the world rebounded from it. Weirdly enough, recently there's been a discovery of a asteroid impact in Greenland on the ice, and some people predict it was as recent as the Younger Dryas. There have been a few people that have stated that this impact caused the devastation to a pre-Younger Dryas civilization and caused them to wipe out. Now, I'm going to break that down in a couple different things. Again, we haven't really found anything that predates the Younger Dryas as far as being an advanced civilization.
Okay.
During the Younger Dryas, the best thing that we had as far as metalworking was essentially cold forging copper, which essentially what that does is you take unrefined copper ore for the most part, clean it up as much as you can, and then you use, well, stones, other things to roll it out and to shape it in, well, cold in a cold environment. You're not using heat to actually forge it.
Okay.
What that actually does is it does compress the copper itself, and it makes it stronger than what it normally would be, but it's not like you're really working with it. You're really tempering it like you would a sword in the Middle Ages.
Okay.
Nothing close to that. So there's a couple negatives to, and by the way, that impact could also have happened 30 million years ago in Greenland. Ugh. So to say that it's as recent as the Younger Dryas is taking a claim that we do not have enough information for. This impact was recently discovered. This crater has not been adequately surveyed of any information from it. So we're going to put that on hold.
Okay.
But if it did impact in the Younger Dryas, and that's what put us into this, again, mini ice age in a lot of ways, what else could we find? We'd probably find some sort of, well, sediment layer that shows a mass extinction of some sort, right? That would just make sense.
Okay.
That's usually
okay.
What we find when it comes to mass extinctions is just a layer of fossil heavy or bone heavy sediment of just tons of different animals that were unfortunately just killed off in this extinction event.
Okay.
We don't really see that. In fact, one of the weirdest things is that even though it's high in the northern hemisphere, one of the easiest megafauna at the time that was definitely dying out was...
Woolly mammoth.
Yeah.
Yes.
And here's the thing. Woolly mammoths, they actually survived quite a while longer, up to about 8,000 years ago, I believe, in some of the most northern islands in Russia.
How'd they get over there?
I mean, there was ice.
Oh, I guess that's fair.
You can travel.
Okay, all right.
You can walk.
Those poor mammoths.
But those mammoths survived. We don't see any kind of mass dying off of animals that would be actually near the impact site whatsoever. And we're not talking about a small crater. It's a fairly decent sized hole in the world.
Long across it is?
It is equivalently the size of, God, what was it? It was, I want to say Britain.
Britain?
No, it wasn't.
Britain?
No, it wasn't that big.
What's this
crater
called?
I can't remember. I don't think it's been formally named.
Oh, man.
31 kilometer wide depression.
All right.
That's a big hole.
That's a big hole. Yeah.
It would be an impact that we would presumably see some sort of reaction to the world at some point in time, right?
Yeah.
But we really don't, not at least in the Younger Dryas. So I definitely think that we have a lot more research and a lot more surveying to do, potentially just deeper into the timeline than what we're actually looking at, potentially.
Okay.
But definitely within the time point where ice covered Greenland. So we're not going incredibly far back, but probably about the same distance as, well, when the last time Antarctica was not Antarctica. probably 34 million years ago, is the oldest that it could possibly be. So it's somewhere between that time point, which gives us a lot of stuff going on. At that time point as well, like 22 million years ago, there was actually a land bridge that connected Antarctica to South America.
Wow.
Once that broke, there was an actual mass extinction, which killed off all the primates in North America because of a giant cold snap, because the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean finally met. And that connection...
Oh, wow.
That connection there reestablished pretty much every kind of water flow throughout the oceans, which is crazy. So
when, I can't
you
even,
gotta like the amount of impact our oceans make is insane.
Think about all the things that have happened to get the world to be what it is today. Yeah.
Speaking
it's
of
insanity,
so let's hop out of the Younger Dryas for a bit,
okay?
And let's talk about more recent things.
All right.
So about 10,000 BCE, we domesticated the goat and began agriculture.
Okay.
We have clear-cut signs of this.
And I have this here that's telling me that in 10,000 BCE was about the end of the last ice age.
Yeah.
Is that... Yeah.
Correct. That's okay. The end of the Younger Dryas.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, then we have, again, copper tools. About 8,000 BC, we have actual written language for the most part. And that's where I'm talking about with Egypt and just basically early civilization
okay.
in general.
Okay.
4,000 BCE... pyramids.
Okay.
I'm sorry. No. 2000 BC. I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
That's all right.
3300 BC, we had the Bronze Age began, which we officially combined copper and tin to create bronze and became essentially the new hotness as far as metal is concerned. So we were actually forging metal tools. And if you didn't have copper, you were losing.
Yeah, you were dead.
Yeah. Now, because of copper, though, is one of the biggest things that actually like happened to the old world, or at least the Mediterranean in general, because generally speaking, copper and tin aren't going to be in the same location. So it
okay.
forced civilizations to cooperate and trade with one another. And because of that cooperation and the network of trade, you have an explosion of, well, for the most part, early empires. Later on, you eventually have the decline of the Bronze Age and the invasion of the Sea Peoples, which is terrifying. What I first thought was that the Sea People could have potentially been this advanced civilization wanting to wreck house on the Mediterranean.
We keep getting people every month who suggest us doing a bonus episode on the Sea People. So... don't talk too much about it, because we'll probably end up doing it.
I'm going to touch on a few things.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
For the most part, the Sea People, historically, are probably just groups of tribesmen that were, for the most part, subjugated by the larger empires and were down on their luck, for the most part, and decided raiding was a good idea in order to actually become wealthy. Which, generally speaking, if you look further in history, or I guess more recent history, the Vikings thought the same exact thing, and they are correct until they realized, well, settling and trading is more profitable than just raiding. Now, the decline of the Bronze Age is theoretically because of these kind of guerrilla-esque warfare of these sea people hitting major civilizations and essentially ransacking the area, but there's also been pretty recent discoveries as well that because of the way that walls have fallen and because of the kind of damage that we see at sites of these really old towns and civilizations in general, that there's an idea that it was just one massive earthquake that created a chain of earthquakes that also brought down a lot of these old civilizations and empires at that time too. So it was potentially a geographic and environmental pressure, and also pressure from these raiding tribesmen.
Interesting.
Otherwise, again, about 2600 BC, we have the pyramids.
Okay.
Now, let's think about that for just a second.
Yeah.
More time has passed from the pyramids to Cleopatra than from Cleopatra to us.
To Pizza Hut. Yeah, man.
When we really think about that, you have essentially, as far as technology has changed in our tools that we use, the early Egyptians did create a very basic form of toothpaste. which was incredibly cool. It actually works pretty well, except it makes your gums bleed like no tomorrow.
Wow.
Which is
you take a little, understandable. You lose a little, yeah.
Exactly. But we went from bronze to now iron weapons at this point in time, which by this point in time, I mean Cleopatra, Roman invasion, that kind of thing. We don't have a huge jump of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Technology grows exponentially. It is really hard for me to assume that anywhere else in the world had a better advantage in order to become a civilization quickly than the Fertile Crescent.
Okay.
One of the big things that is believed to support a civilization is the ability to domesticate animals and to essentially have animals that are, well, just essentially for work.
Yeah.
Now, goats, sheep, and cows have all been domesticated from Anatolia.
Okay.
The Turkish peninsula, essentially. Okay. So East Asia, or West Asia. Sorry, I apologize. They all come from that area.
Okay.
Which is the north of the Fertile Crescent. These work animals have helped us tremendously to build our civilization because it gives us more time to then specialize than what we would have if we were just literally plowing the fields ourselves. It's hard to say that this jump has also been made elsewhere in a better impact. When we look at the Americas, for the most part, they're still in the Stone Age by the time Columbus came around.
Mm.
I'm not saying that they weren't a large civilization, but they didn't have the advantages that the Fertile Crescent mm-hmm. did. They didn't have large work animals. The closest thing that they had was llamas and alpacas, which llamas can get, you know, just under 6 feet high, so just under 2 meters. Llamas or alpacas are much smaller, so as far as a work animal goes, probably not going to be nearly as helpful.
Mm.
And at that time, that was just in South America, along really Chile and Peru. That region. It wasn't where we had the truly massive civilizations that were in the middle of the Central America. Don't get me wrong, the Incas are a massive civilization, but they didn't have nearly the technology needed to really become an expansive civilization that, well, Western Europe had advantage of. Otherwise, from there, we do have some pretty incredible seafarers around this time as well. So about 15,000 BC. Or okay. 1500 BC. I apologize. Probably the most impressive to my mind is the Polynesian wayfinders, which they set sail across the Pacific at this point in time in a double canoed, essentially canoes. They used a double canoe basic platform. And the way that they actually traveled was incredible. Okay. They did make sea charts, but their sea charts weren't necessarily about land masses. They were more about how the water swells and moves in the Pacific.
Wow.
And they also used the sun, the stars to navigate, and also clouds, believe it or not, because clouds do tend to mass up over land in general. They were able to travel the Pacific without anything close to modern technology, which is insane. And it goes to show just how much more that really old peoples knew so much that we don't.
Yeah.
We collectively know a ton.
Yeah.
Way more than what our ancestors could ever possibly know. But individually, our ancestors would kick our butt.
Don't get me wrong. I do not think that the ancient people had the ability to levitate rocks and to open space portals. That's not what I'm here to say. But what I am here to say is that all of you people who are like, this is the entire problem with the ancient alien hypothesis. How could they have done it? They were just primitive people. I'm going to stick you on a boat in the middle of the ocean and see if you can make it to North America.
Right. As technology expands, we lose our ability to do other things. Yeah. They had an innate connection to nature, and it was life or death. For us, it's not.
Even like you were mentioning, your central, northern, and southern American civilizations, yes, they may not have had the same military might. They may not have had the same
advantages, level
of technology, but they still, I mean, the Mayan calendar is more accurate to the
yeah, they still had math.
Than ours. I mean, they had... These people are the reason that we have what we have. And so this is my problem with the ancient alien hypothesis more than anything else.
What's truly amazing is that there has been Polynesian DNA found in descendants of South Americans.
See?
Which is just incredible.
Check that.
At this point in time as well, the Phoenicians are actually charting and navigating the entire Mediterranean, and they have passed the Iberian Peninsula and actually gone out into the Atlantic Ocean.
Free water, man.
To give you an idea, this is essentially the time point where major human sea navigation is starting to occur, which is amazing in so many different ways. As far as the increase of sailing and trade and everything like that, we do see a lot of improvements in the Mediterranean. Of course, after that, unfortunately, the Polynesians are fairly island-locked, and they stay in fairly small ships, while the Mediterranean, they have something to actually fight over, which is great, because what that pretty much means is that we get some really awesome ships.
We're going to take a quick break. Jason, you hold that thought. You hold it right there.
I'm trying to remember how to pronounce a Greek word, so it's going to take a second.
Okay, we'll be right back. Losing hair sucks. Most people don't realize how much they care about their hair until they notice they have started losing it. And that's why we at Not Alone recommend Keeps. Keeps is the easiest and most affordable way to keep the hair you have. Now, these FDA-approved products, which used to cost so much, are finally, through Keeps, inexpensive and easy to get. For 5 minutes now and just $1 a day, you'll never have to worry about hair loss again, because getting started with Keeps is so easy that sign up takes less than 5 minutes. All you have to do is answer a few questions and snap some photos of your hair. At that point, a licensed physician will review your information online and recommend the right treatment for you. Then, it's shipped right to your door every 3 months. Now, Keeps offers generic versions of the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there. Some of you have probably even tried them before, but you've never gotten them for this low of a price. Keeps is available for as low as $10 a month. Plus, now, you can get your first month for free. Now, that's one heck of a deal for getting to keep your hair. Now, to receive your first month of treatment for free, go to keeps.com/alone. That's KEEPS.com/ALONE. That's a free month of treatment at keeps.com/alone. Keeps. Hair today, hair tomorrow. All right, and we're back. We're back. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, at about 480 BC, the Mediterranean experiences its first incredibly large warship that had about a crew of 200 people and 170 oars. Now, why this is important? At this point in time, the hulls of ships in the Mediterranean were essentially stacked pieces of lumber that were pegged together and then sealed with wax and other just basically small vegetation debris, mm-hmm, in order to make it watertight, theoretically.
As best as we can, yeah.
With 170 orders, they would actually be able to ram and maneuver around these smaller ships, because at this point in time, naval combat was basically board and all artillery were your two options. This ship revolutionized that to where now you could just ram right into your opponent, back up quickly. And this is the problem, like at 170 oars, that is a triple layer of oars.
Yeah.
Incredibly significant amount of people, but it takes a lot of skill in order to direct it properly.
Yeah.
Because at this point in time, as soon as you ram someone, guess what? You're stuck in a position to where you're now able to be rammed quite easily. Yeah. So the oars had to be on top of it. Otherwise, without an experienced naval crew, you would also be very susceptible to just dying by being just rammed.
Just getting wrecked.
Because those rams would just essentially peel right in between the layers of that stacked, essentially, sidewalls of the ships. And at this point in time, before that, before this size of a ship, you'd have about 50-man crews of oars and much smaller. And at that point in time, you would also have stories of just full fleets being lost at sea.
Dang.
So these ships really brought to power like the first real man of war style ships of the Mediterranean, which is really cool. And then again, 332 BCE, Alexander conquers Egypt.
The Great.
And then eventually we get, you know, the Library of Alexandria, and that's where theoretically some of those charts came from, right? Theoretically.
All right, we'll come
but
back around.
At this point in time, we don't have any other significant examples or really any evidence because we have written language already. We have ways to write down events. You would think that we'd be able to write down events that included some sort of more advanced civilization that came in and, well, spoke to us at the very least, right?
Sure.
Or shared information and put information in the Library of Alexandria, that kind of thing. Where we don't. We don't have any knowledge of that. You think it'd be rather important for all civilizations in the Mediterranean for that to be a thing that was chronicalized, but it's not. And at that point in time, I have to say that we're talking, again, 332 BC is when Alexander came to Egypt. And of course, the Library of Alexandria was built after that. If we're talking about a civilization that happened during the Younger Dryas, which was 13,000 years ago, how could we possibly expect parchment to survive that long?
Yeah,
which
for sure.
Our map here was written a little over 500 years ago, and we have a third of it. Tell me how any kind of civilization, any kind of written documentation from that civilization is going to survive an ice age and was probably unprotected whatsoever as far as what we do nowadays with significant documents, like, for example, the Declaration of Independence. It's locked up incredibly tight. It's humidity locked. It doesn't even get exposed to very much light because light will reduce the ink and eventually fade it. So there are a lot of things like that get exposed that would not be able to survive a cataclysmic event to be found later on.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, these old documents are still, even if it's not noticeable, and definitely not to the what it would be like if they were just sitting out, they do still have to go through constant preservation and restoration efforts, to like hands-on efforts to stop them from being unreadable and being lost. I once read that everybody, not everybody, certain types of people lament like the loss of the Library of Alexandria, and rightfully so. You know, it was the greatest, as far as we can tell, the greatest repository of knowledge in the ancient world. It's very akin, though, to what happened. There was a something that happened in the East. There was like an emperor who took over and was like, all right, we're going to burn everything from before me, is essentially what happened there. But
don't you just love emperors where they're like, hey, I'm better than the old guy, so let's just destroy everything the old guy had?
Not even just the old guy, everything.
But that's just constant throughout history.
But in Alexandria, I once read that we probably still have like 90% of the information and knowledge that was collected in that library.
I'm sure there's
because
more than one
copy. from different sources. That was just a wonderful collection, a wonderful
location where you can have all this knowledge.
And the other thing is, I mean, like you're saying here, so the typical response that people say is when you're looking at these lost civilizations and advanced civilizations, you typically see it to be a conflagration, I think is how you say that, maybe not, of many different factors. And most of them are, I mean, mythic. I mean, we have, you know, okay, so we have Atlantis, obviously. That's the number one thing. So if you take Atlantis, supposedly somewhere probably in the Mediterranean, but maybe further out. And then you also have, theoretically, thousands of years later, these sea people showing up. Okay, so maybe these two are connected in some way. But really, when you really look at the sea people and realize, like you were saying, it's most likely just ragtag groups of people trying to survive.
Yeah.
They are not coming with laser beams and flying machines. And that, you know, Atlantis was always, in Plato's writings, a myth, and specifically a thought experiment. It just does. It just falls apart. I think that people...
Right, but that's not a fun story.
No, it's not a fun story.
We like the thought experiment.
And I really...
We love it.
I really think that what we don't understand is how very similar life was for the longest time. I mean, yes, we had all of these wonderful things that happened, but they happened the over 13,000 years, you know.
We were still trying to fight off wolves from eating us.
Right. I mean,
you know, like in like death and famine and disease, it took a long time before civilization could start to where we do separate ourselves from the natural world. We do have permanent shelter so that we don't have to worry about finding somewhere to sleep for the evening.
But even once we hit that point, I mean, your day-to-day life is very similar for stretches of hundreds, if not thousands of years at a time.
Yeah,
if
exactly.
Society, because like that's the thing is, oh, well, let's say that there was a civilization that made it through this little, or this ice age and all of this, well, they would have been thousands of years ahead of the Fertile Crescent right. and things like that. Well, yeah, but that doesn't actually mean as much as you think it means.
It also, we excavate quite a lot. It's not like we're trying to skip anything that happened before the Younger Dryas. We are absolutely trying to excavate sites to find out more about not only, of course, humans, but every other animal that existed at that point in time.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're not looking for stuff.
Yeah.
We absolutely are. We just haven't found anything of significance.
Yeah. If human civilization always expanded at the rate of the post-Enlightenment, the last 2.5 centuries, then yeah, that'd be a totally viable theory. Oh, they had 3,000 years, and if they went from frickin' not having cars to having Teslas in the period of 100 years, then yeah, that would be possible. But in reality, that's just not how it's worked for the majority of civilization. So
now, bummer. I'm not completely done yet because I do want to talk about a little bit more because, man, I went such like down a rabbit hole of how
nice.
Like maritime navigation came about and like how we're even doing things. For a lot of times, I'm not gonna lie, guys, it was mostly like keep my fingers crossed and keep an eye offshore. Like hopefully I don't get caught
if
by
we're lucky,
rogue wave or something.
We won't die.
Exactly. Again, the Phoenicians started charting the Mediterranean about 1500 BCE. Awesome, cool. Mediterranean, kind of discovered, got it. From there though, the rest of the world was tough to navigate. One of the big issues that Arabic civilized culture found is that the eastern coast of Africa is very mean to ships.
Oh, no.
And what I mean by that is basically it was very like turmoil, high swells, that kind of thing as far as navigating through it. So it's rough to do. I want to say 900 AD.
Okay.
So I'm moving up to the time point quite
moving
a lot.
Up.
They came up with essentially a board and rope tactic where you have a rectangle cut of board, a rope coming or a string really coming from the center of it. And then to use it, you would, this is to figure out your longitude, you would hold it, the bottom of the board at essentially sea level or the horizon line. And then the top of the board would be at the base of the sun.
Okay.
And then as far, and you would hold the string in your mouth. And as far close that you would have to be, so the distance between your arm and your mouth and how you're seeing it is essentially that distance of rope will tell you what your longitude is.
God.
So all they had to do to find ports on the east coast of Africa, all they had to do was essentially figure out where that board needed to be so they can figure out their longitude and then figure out east and west. Fairly easy with east and west because of the sun.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So then they'd just be like, okay, now we're at the right longitude. Let's just sail west, and we'll get to our right port. Some of these were discovered that had different knots in the same piece of string so that they had essentially a list of different ports that they needed to be at. Some of them just had literally a board for every major port that they were going to, that they were sailing at, which was pretty impressive. Later on, a similar device was created called the Long Cross. Basically the same exact thing. It was a long piece of wood that also had another piece of wood that slid across the bar. Now, you would do the same exact thing where you would line up the bottom piece of the slide bar to the horizon line, and then you'd line the top piece of that line to the sun. Not great for your eyes.
Yeah.
But again, same exact thing. You would just slide it back and forth towards your cheek in order to get the correct longitude. Later on, there was the back cross, I believe is what it's called, which did that with shadows.
Oh, okay.
And so you'd get the correct measurement from the shadow. And
good
then,
news, we don't have to stare into the sun anymore.
With some basic mathematics, you would be able to figure out where you're at.
Wow.
Which is crazy. One other thing that I love. Have you ever heard of the Viking Sunstone?
Oh, I have heard of the Sunstone. I saw it.
The mythical stone.
You'd hold it, and even through cloudy days,
you would still be able to know where the sun is at. Yes. And even if it's past the horizon line. And it's a real thing.
What?
It's a real thing. Okay,
all right.
Here we go.
Okay, all right.
So the Sunstone is actually a piece of Icelandic spar, essentially a fairly clear stone. And what it does is catch the polarization of the sun's rays.
Okay.
And when you have, say, like a dot on one side of the spar that you're looking at, if you are looking through the stone itself, you'll get two different images of it, of the dot. Now, you know you're looking directly at the sun when those images are the exact same in intensity and in brightness.
Okay.
And you would be able to see this through any weather, which is incredibly cool. So this is one way that, and it was found in an old shipwreck in 1590, from 1590, which is incredibly cool. And before that, we just assumed that it might be something mythological, it might be something real, but we didn't actually have it with other navigational tools until about then. Otherwise, the compass was built, or I think originally created, somewhere around 1200 AD. I might be a little off by a couple hundred years, but roughly early medieval period, which that was really discovered from lodestones. Which lodestone is just a naturally occurring magnetic rock. And then we were able to figure out that we can just magnetize needles off of those. And we used that for navigation for quite a long time. One of the biggest fleets ever actually used it to navigate, which is the Treasure Fleet from China. This fleet was the largest in the world at the time, actually larger than any other fleet combined.
Okay.
Of the known world, and that fleet sailed from China all the way to East Africa. So it explored Indonesia, India, all the way over to East Africa as this giant naval fleet, which is insane.
Yeah.
So we've done some really cool stuff throughout the ages, but it has taken a lot of time, and it has taken a lot of effort on a humanity-wide scale for us to be able to start navigating like this.
Yeah.
So it's really tough for me to assume that this map, the Perry Reese map, does show Antarctica in its truest form, and it's meant to be that way. One other thing that I picked up on as well, going over some of the Chinese navigation tools, is that maps typically, there are some that were like 9 meters long, and really it wasn't perfectly to scale or anything like that, but what it does is more promptly illustrate the coastline,
okay,
the actual shoreline of the areas that the treasure fleet was going to be going through. I wouldn't be surprised if that same tactic was used elsewhere as well. I would imagine that shorelines are important in a lot of ways. It wouldn't come to any surprise to me to hear that the Perry Reese map on the coastline of the New World, the more important thing was the coastline itself, not necessarily it being perfectly accurate as far as where that coast is.
Yeah, that would make sense.
So I think there's some scrutiny that you have to look at. And as far as these claims go, guys, if something sounds a little out there, do some of your own research. Take a look at it through an eye and be like, okay, is whatever this person is trying to say about this thing, this subject, could they be right? Take a little bit of scrutiny to it and say, okay, well, if that's the case, does anything support it? And nothing really does.
Yeah.
And this map is incredibly cool. It is very interesting to look at. But I really, you are grasping at straws if you want to say an ancient civilization before the most recent ice age created this, or even closely after the ice age created this. I'll listen to you. But you're going to have to back it up with a lot more credibility than what we have currently.
Yeah. Yeah. It basically sounds like it is simply look at that. That looks kind of like Antarctica.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I think so. some of the reason is, and also going back to the gentleman that originally believed it to be Antarctica, what was his name? Arlington H. Mallory. He was also an amateur archaeologist and a believer in a pre-Columbus transatlantic...
By the Chinese?
Trade system. Okay. No. Transatlantic. Oh, okay. So I'm talking old world, new world.
Oh, okay.
West Africa to essentially South America.
Because there's like this idea that the Chinese beat Columbus to the new world, and it sounds legit, but then when you look at it, it's not legit. There's a great episode on...
I mean, the span of the Pacific is wider than all the span if we plug together all the landmass.
Yeah. There's a great episode on Our Fake History about that very concept. So if you're interested in that, go listen to that episode. It's great.
Otherwise, I mean, like I said, the Polynesians, they did incredible feats of navigation.
Yeah.
To a scale that I still can't fathom. It's just wild. It really is. Like, it's just incredible that humans were able to do that at that point in time on things that I would not want to leave the site of shore on. Like, no, I don't just, do that to
it
me.
It just makes me want to watch Moana, to be honest.
That's I don't blame you whatsoever.
So good.
But I have a couple scrutinies with the idea that a pre-Columbus trade between the old world and the new world occurred as well. Some people are grasping at straws with that because the new world is fairly rich in both copper and tin, so it'd make an advantage to do that, mm-hmm. to be able to have that trade. But then at that point, you would be trading other things as well. Okay. You don't just go for raw material. You would see a lot of the same trade that we had when Columbus did come to the new world. You would see things like agricultural trade. You would see things like livestock and domestication trade. And then you'd also, again, see the trade of disease.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like this, we would have a much bigger impact than what we do. So, I mean, that is, again, grasping at straws. And when you hear something like that, just do a little bit more side research and see what's going on. But that is my take on the Perry Reese map. One of the coolest things that I've probably looked into in a very long time, and one of the coolest people I've probably looked into in a very long time as well. But if you have some questions, feel free to grab us over at Facebook and
or Twitter or
anywhere. I will usually respond.
Will you
throw it at me? I would love to talk more about it. This topic became so expansive that I literally just sat in front of my computer. I have still probably about 20 tabs open of just information that I was trying to gather, and it's still tough to piece together just how we were able to do all this stuff when we did.
Yeah, I mean, that was basically just an hour and a half long history lesson on navigation and also ice ages and human civilization.
We did some really cool stuff.
Yeah, I'm all about it. I'm on board. I'm on board. Cool.
Do you have any questions for me?
I don't. I think I've brought them up kind of throughout the thing. No, dude, was just super, that was super expansive.
Yeah, it was very, like I said, it was either we're going to talk about the map for 20 minutes or we're gonna dive into some stuff.
Yeah, totally.
And more than happy to dive into it some more. I was a lot of very enthusiastic research over the past couple of weeks doing this.
Yeah, it was very well presented, very well done. We probably will have to eventually do a full-blown patron episode on the sea people, because I know a lot of people keep asking for it and wanting it. So we may do that this month. We do have our voting open.
I did half of the homework already on it.
We do have our poll open. It'll be open for, what's the date today? It's the 7th. This will go up. So it'll be open for another 2 or 3 days once this goes up.
Sweet.
So make sure that if you're one of our $5 patrons, you head over there. Let me know. Well, technically we have the suggestion post open. So let me know.
You want more geeky on the late Bronze Age.
He's all about it.
Hit me up. Let's go for it.
He is all about it. No, I don't have any other questions. I think that was fantastically well done.
So in that case, I guess we just have the outro. Do we have anyone to thank this week, Sam?
We do have people to thank. And once again, can't remember who we have and haven't done.
We just need to, like an idiot. Can you highlight them? Can we do something?
I should probably just delete the ones that we've done, I would think. So
that would be smart.
Maybe I'll do that this week. Anyway, so we're going to think. Okay. Let's try this. Let's just see what happens here. Okay. We'd like to thank Amanda Vaughn. All right, yeah, Amanda. And by the way, these are people who are patrons.
Okay, thank you. Because we usually do reviews. Are we doing reviews at all? What are we doing?
Wow, I am out of it today. Yes, these are our new patrons. Anything from as low as $1, you get a shout out on the show. So these are our new patrons, and we would like to thank them. We'd like to thank Amanda Vaughn.
Woo, all right, Amanda.
We'd like to thank William Love.
Woo, yeah, William.
We'd like to thank Terry M. Roberts.
Hey, Terry.
We'd like to thank Morgan. All right.
Yeah, Morgan.
We'd like to thank Stacy Beatty. Hey,
oh, yeah, Stacy.
We'd like to thank Brian Young.
Yeah, Brian.
We'd like to meet, or no, we'd like.
we're meeting someone
we
now.
We would like to meet. We would like to thank Aiden. All right.
Ooh, Aiden.
We'd like to thank, I've not been to this web address. This is their name. I'm going to call it out. And if it's weird, don't blame me. I don't know what
it is. Well, we're a weird podcast. So that makes sense. It looks fine.
It looks fine. We'd like to thank snowflow.org.
Yeah, hey, snowflow.org.
That was that seemed unnatural. We'd like to thank Rafi Rodriguez.
Woo, hey, Rafi.
And we'd like to thank John Stein.
Yeah, John.
If you're interested in supporting the show, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn more. You get a shout out, as we've just done. You also get early, so that's the $1 sphere. The $3 sphere, you get early access to the unedited episodes. It's typically 1 to 3 days early. And sometimes, like in our last episode, the Golem episode, I actually cut out, for time and other reasons, some of the actual like content, the informational stuff. A lot of times you just get the raw and you get it early, and sometimes there's jokes that I cut out or whatever. But in any case, it's just a great way of having early access as our way of saying thank you. And then at the $5 level, you get everything else, and you get a guaranteed at least one bonus episode a month, every month that you get a vote on the topic of. Sometimes I'll take over and say, nah, we're going to do it on this. But typically it's that you suggest it.
Like a dictator.
Like a dictator. Typically it's that you suggest it. And even if I think it's complete and utter crap, we still research it.
You mean like Space Penguins?
Like Space Penguins, Rob, which is what this last month's episode was. So you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn more about that. We'd also like to thank, we have two new iTunes reviews.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So we would like to thank Booger TDB, I guess. And we'd like to thank Kujkujur. Guys, what's up? What's going on?
Where are y'all from?
We're gonna read Kujkujur. KJKJRRRR. Is how that's spelled. And they say, I love Astonishing Legends. This is not Astonishing Legends. And was looking for another show along those lines when I found Not Alone. That's us.
Thank you. I had no idea.
What I first thought would be a decent substitute while waiting for new episodes of Astonishing Legends has become one of my favorite shows. The hosts are thoughtful, sincere, and goofy, and make you want to join in the conversation. It's definitely worth your time if you're a fan of strange, spooky, and weird stories. I hope they can afford more lights. Thank you, Kujkujur. We have a lot of lights. Actually, Jason is buying more lights, or will be buying
three.
More lights.
Yes.
Three more lights? Wow. That's wild.
Two sides and one on top.
All right, because we are at some point. What's our ETA on this?
I'm hoping to have everything ready for next week.
Next week?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Hoping.
We'll see about that.
So, I'm not gonna lie. I think I told you last week, but my sander dies once I'm about halfway through.
You had mentioned that.
And I've gone through probably about 6 different sanding sessions between then and now. Huh. So I just need to essentially straighten out a few things and finalize it and stain it. It's Throw Out the Lights. So I'm close.
Okay. All right. Okay.
It is actually pretty close. It's just that's what's taken probably the longest at this point.
Well, we are trying to go because
I don't want us to get like slivers.
Yeah. No. That's fair.
I'm trying my best to make sure that we won't get stabbed by wood.
I appreciate that. I hate being stabbed by wood.
Yeah.
We are attempting to go video. So, and I think we're going to do it this time. It's only taken us.
It would have been really helpful for this one.
This is 99 episodes in. Maybe for our 100th episode is what you're saying. Well, I don't know about that because that we're going to be collaborating with somebody from afar.
Well, shoot.
So I don't know.
101. Maybe. We'll talk about the Dalmatians as well.
We'll figure it out. And in regards to that next episode, so that everybody knows, we're going to look at the way that Stanley Kubrick faked the moon landing. And then we're going to talk about this moon landing thing for a few weeks.
Aww.
Because next week is going to be just Stanley Kubrick. I was talking to Brian from the Double Density podcast, and he was like, there is so much here. There is enough here.
No.
And so he's actually going to he's going to come on, and we're going to talk about the weird life of Stanley Kubrick in general, but especially in regards to the moon landing. And then we'll probably do we'll definitely do at least one, but probably two more episodes. One on what I hope will be some of the more plausible theories, and then one on some of the completely insane theories, all about how we faked the moon landing. So that is what we're going to do for our 100th episode, which is next week. So anyway, what did you say?
I said I'm going to need a sedative.
Yeah, you just fall asleep. So stay tuned for all of that. That is coming down the Not Alone pipe right into your ears, whether you like it or not. Nope, that's not true.
That's
not true. You can always turn off. You have the power. Anyway, this has been a great ramble.
Lovely.
One of my favorites, actually.
Anyway, Sam, where can you find the podcast?
All sorts of places.
That's the spirit.
You can find us on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. I'm on Twitter at Beardlord Elfbane, and Jason's on Twitter at
Mighty Moit.
Mighty Moit. You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast and join our Facebook group. Remember, we are not alone, a community for the strange. You can not find us on Instagram.
We're like a cryptid.
Let's see.
We're
Bigfoot. I'm gonna open up Instagram right now.
You might be able to find traces of us, but not enough to be credible.
Let's see how many missed notifications we have from Instagram.
Do I even want to know? I don't actually.
It's loading.
It's probably just gonna like fake account followed you. Fake account followed you.
We have 33 new followers.
Guys, what the flip?
And 15
likes.
What
are they following?
I don't know, because we have not posted since August. So we're coming up on 1 year of not posting on Instagram. So anyway, don't follow us on Instagram. We're truly not going to. We don't care. And then you can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. Or you could also email us at notalonepodstories@gmail.com. So the first one is if you just want to say hi or have like a question or something. The second one is if you have a story that you would like to be considered for inclusion in one of our bonus or one of our listener specials, which pretty much we're going to do as soon as we have enough stories. So feel free to send them over and we'll get crack-a-lackin' on that. So, yeah, okay. That's all we got?
Cool.
That's a whole lot of talking. All
right, I know for sure you did it last week.
How do you know?
Because I remember. I remember I did not do it.
Okay, so when we had the alien show up at the school and 100 school children remembered aliens, that was not trustworthy. But you remembering that I did it last week, I'm just supposed to take that on faith, huh?
I mean, would you like to go back in time?
I think I would.
Check the last you want to listen to the last podcast right now? Huh? You just fast forward to the end. It'll be fine. Just do it. Do it. I dare you. Anyway.
All right, go ahead. I trust you.
Remember, whether you're gazing through a stone to find the sun.
Hell yeah.
Or your ship is ramming into another for naval warfare. You are
not alone.